KJZZ's original production, The Show, is supported by Banner Health, Arizona's largest nonprofit healthcare system. Last year, Banner reinvested more than $1.1 billion in community health and charity care. Banner Health, nonprofit for Arizona. BannerHealth.com/nonprofit4AZ.
Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the efforts on both sides of the border to get New World screwworm under control. And as the valley deals with highs north of 110, we'll learn about the world of swimming in ice-cold water. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news over the last week or so.
We've been focused on what potential federal interference there will be. We are going to be watching this very closely, and we're working closely with election officials across the state to ensure that our elections are secure.
This mass deportation is not what the American people want. We're going to continue to provide strong oversight, but the announcement by the Attorney General of the agreement with Homeland Security to delay any further action on the surprise warehouse is very good news.
After years of lifting up the issues that the ESA reform system had in this state, that there's a potential to get something done.
The Republicans in charge of the legislature have decided to throw firefighters, police officers, and teachers under the bus in order to protect the waste, fraud, and abuse in the ESA voucher program.
Nobody asked me to negotiate this. They said, "What do you think?" And I said, "What I think." And I still think that's the most equitable deal.
What we needed was a more robust paid program to get us over the top. I mean, the volunteers can sincerely only get so far.
And with me to talk about the state Supreme Court siding with Maricopa County's recorder in his dispute with the Board of Supervisors, a familiar face taking the lead on support for a ballot measure this fall, and more, our former state lawmaker, Regina Cobb. Regina, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
And Don Panich of Agave Strategy. Don, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Regina, let's start with Maricopa County. This has been, I feel like we've talked about this every week for the last who knows however many weeks it's been going on. But we got some guidance this week from the state Supreme Court, which sided with recorder Justin Heap in his conflict with the Board of Supervisors, basically over who runs what when it comes to elections in Maricopa County and what funding goes for and all that sort of thing. I'm curious what you make of what the court had to say and what the impacts of that might be.
I think the court made the right decision. There is clear outlines of who does what with Maricopa County. The supervisors do their general election. He does the primary election. I know they made a deal with the last recorder, but if they wanted to make a deal with him, they should have done that. And they didn't. And so you go back to what the laws dictate.
Do you have concerns about this ruling coming when it did, in the sense that people had already voted and are continuing to vote as they're trying to implement this?
Yes, I do. I did have concerns with that, and I still have concerns because I think some of the things that he might wanted to have done or should have done were delayed and were already into the primary.
Yeah, Don, I mean, how concerned, I guess, should Maricopa County voters be that, you know, this ruling comes down this week when voting has been going on for a little while already? We'll continue with the primary in just a couple of weeks now.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a structure in place, right? There are places to go vote. There is a mail-in deadline. So for someone who wants to make sure their vote gets in and gets counted, the infrastructure is there. But yeah, it's a question that we won't understand, unfortunately, until retrospect allows us to look back and kind of understand what else could have been open, what else should have happened. So, you know, Helen Purcell, previous recorders have kind of said things should be okay. But I think what's most important is that we have a really good understanding. And I am very personally curious to know how the relationship between the supervisors and the recorder is from this point on. And it's been over a year of constant suing one another back and forth. But at the 11th hour, they actually struck a compromise that the court ruling now supersedes, apparently. But I'm very curious, what was that compromise? Could that have been the first step toward a more productive relationship that will matter in the general?
Well, Dawn, when you talk about the relationship, I think it's fair to say that it has been not great, right, between most of the supervisors and the recorder. What will you be looking for going forward then? Because obviously, you know, the primaries, as we've talked about in a couple weeks, but of course, the general election is not that far away.
Right. Well, you know, up until this point, it's been a lot of questions over who has the authority to do what. And if that's what you're focused on, then you're not having conversations about what can we be doing together. And so that's what I want to see, is whether they stick with the court ruling, which gave Heap everything, or whether there is some going back to the compromise that they had reached. Can we have more of a everybody's in this together sense? The supervisors have long said that that's all they want. They just want to be able to all be on the same page. Will the recorder be able to move
Although
forward
I
that
think
way?
They're both still adversarial, because if you look at the posts that they're putting out, like Justin Heap just put out his announcement yesterday that his 19-point plan or whatever it is. And then you get a supervisor saying, we haven't seen it yet. When are you going to give it to us? So there's still some hard feelings going on there.
Can that be rectified? I mean, you've served in elected office. Can that be rectified in time for November?
I don't know if it can be rectified completely in time for November. I think we probably, just what Dawn said, things are in place right now. So I think we'll probably go through this next general election. And until we can look back and say, this should have been done and this could have been done if everybody was on the same page, I think we're probably not going to be able to rectify what happens this year. But going forward, hopefully we can.
Anything in particular you're looking for in terms of maybe differences between how things happen in Maricopa County between the July primary and the November general?
I don't see any differences between the primary and the general. I think we're going to be on task. And just what you said, Purcell said, you know, everything is in place. We're good to go. So I think they'll be fine. I think there could have been improvements. And I think the differences of what the supervisors want and what he wants could be compromised after this.
Dawn, is there a potential perception issue among voters? I mean, I feel like we've been hearing basically for the last 6 years about how there are problems with elections and they're rigged and lawsuits and everything. Even if everything is on the up and up and everything goes very smoothly, does all the fighting between the various entities here, does that do anything to voters?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think, honestly, like we were saying, there are processes in place. There are voting locations, all of that. That's why it has actually been my top concern through all of this is the public perception of our election system and the trust and faith that voters have in that system and in their vote being counted. Because if you get too much of the populace to get to a place of it's all corrupt, what does it even matter? I'm sitting this one out. That is not good for our state, for our democracy. And so that's the number one thing that I hope would come out of some kind of either getting on the same page, agreeing to the court order, a compromise solution, whatever it is starting to have all voices in unison. And Recorder Heap will be the toughest one because he has a history of election denialism, getting everyone on the same page saying our elections are accurate, they are fair, we want you to vote, and we want you to figure out how to best vote in the way that suits your lifestyle.
So, Regina, one of the ways that election skeptics, election deniers have been trying to make their case is claiming that people who are not citizens of this country are voting, which we know data show that that is exceedingly rare for non-citizens to vote. But this week, the Department of Justice in Washington sent what Adrian Fontes, the Secretary of State, called a nasty gram to election officials here and elsewhere, basically saying, we will prosecute you if we find that there are non-citizens on the voter rolls or who actually vote. Like, obviously, a lot of states have already had their primaries and voted. Arizona's in the middle of it, as we've talked about, the general coming up in a few months. Like, are you expecting to see election officials being handcuffed here?
Oh, no, I don't. What I do see is just what happened is that they were citing all the laws, saying you need to abide by all of these rules that we have. You got 5 days to respond to this. That's a short time period. And I think that's why he looked at it as a nasty grab. But really, and at the very end of the letter, it says, and we would like to help you, you know. So if you need help, this is it. But as long as we're abiding by the laws, I don't think there's anything that we're going to have to be concerned about. And just what you said, it's a rare thing when it happens. So if everything goes smoothly and it's we're all, you know, in accordance to what we need to do, I think we'll be fine.
So why send the letter then? If it is very, very, very rare for non-citizens to vote and election officials are saying we are following the laws, why send the letter in the first place?
It's a political move. Yeah. It makes it look good. And, you know, saying I'm enforcing this, that's exactly what it is.
Do you agree with that, Don? You're nodding your head. Political theater here?
It's a PR stunt, you know, and what it does is serve the larger Trump narrative of, you know, election inaccuracy or stolen elections, because it begs the question, well, why did the Department of Justice have to send that letter? The answer is for no reason. They just chose to, you know, to get some headlines. But it still plants that seed in the minds of folks saying, well, what's actually going on? And the answer is, everything that's going on is above board, accurate, valid. And, you know, this is Arizona. The vast majority of our county recorders are Republicans who want to make sure that every vote is counted, regardless of who is in the White House.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, so I wonder, Don, if you think that this in any way helps Adrian Fontes in his reelection bid. He's, of course, going to be on the ballot come November for his reelection bid. Like he and, you know, his signs say, you know, protect the voter or something like that. I might be paraphrasing. But like, does this become a campaign issue for him?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, lots of surveys have been done in Arizona and nationally that people do not like federal meddling in local and state elections. And so the Fontes campaign has obviously done some polling and figured out that as long as he's standing up for our elections to go the way we, the people of Arizona, want them to go, that is a popular position to be in for his reelect.
Regina, you were nodding as well. You think does this help Fontes, do you think?
I think it does. I think he's going to use it all the way through his general election. So some of the things that we do are backfire on us, you know? And so I think this is going to be one of those things that he's going to like continually put out there. Look, I'm doing the right thing. And they don't think I'm doing the right thing, but I am. You know, so I think he's gonna utilize it.
Okay, so guys, one more quick thing before we take a break, related to how we vote and the way elections are run. Don, we saw a couple of weeks ago now a group that was trying to collect signatures to put a referendum on the ballot dealing with, protecting mail-in voting and that kind of thing, expanding voting hours, that sort of thing. They realized they did not have the signatures, so they did not turn them in. This is something you have done before. You've been out, you know, trying to collect signatures to get stuff on the ballot. Are you surprised that they fell short?
No, they started really late for the number of – this was to be a constitutional amendment, which
threshold.
Is the higher number of signatures. They started really late with only a couple months to go and with not the type of funding that's required to pay for that degree of signature collection. But, you know, the organizers knew that going in, and I at least have heard them say, we just wanted to put the conversation out there to start talking about other ways to protect mail voting and our voting system. So I don't think that even the organizers were surprised that they didn't make it.
Okay. Regina, do you agree?
I think that they really wanted to say that there's another referendum out there and we want you to be aware of what is out there and what's going on with that one. And so we're going to do this. I don't think they planned on getting the signatures.
Do you think that conversation does raise the conversation at least about the measure that is on the ballot that the legislature referred?
It does. And that referendum still has to be approved. And the language was, I think they looked at the language yesterday and there's three parts to that. And even though they're all three conjunction with each other, they're trying to do the single subject denial on that one.
Well, a legal challenge to try to get it kicked off. Interesting. Don, let me start with you on some ESA stuff, a lot of ESA stuff actually going on. Supporters of some guardrails, I guess you could call them, on the ballot turned in their signatures a lot more than needed. They were immediately challenged by critics. At the same time, a proposal to maybe have a legislative deal to keep some initiatives off the ballot in exchange for some legislative guardrails fizzled out as a potential special session. I'm curious where you see where do you see this issue standing right now as, you know, these initiatives are the legal process going through, the signature verification is going to happen, you know, assuming that all these make the ballot, where do you see this standing?
Yeah, well, okay. So a couple parts to that question.
Sorry, it's a very broad, basically here, vouchers go.
Yeah, yeah.
Is what I asked.
Well, let me answer the first part, the last part first. If the measure to put up by the teachers union and public education advocates, if that does get to the November ballot, it will pass with flying colors. We know that any time private school vouchers are put to the people, and this is in Arizona, but also across the country, that voters look to limit, stop, or regulate private school vouchers. So I fully expect that to be the case. Now, whether the poison pill measure that Republicans put on the ballot.
That's in the bill for the referendum for military families, ESAs.
Right.
Yeah.
And we know that it's a poison pill because you know, there are around 100,000 students on the ESA voucher program currently. About 1,000 of those 100,000 are military families. So we know that this is, you know, kind of being put up as a poster child, a sympathetic poster child, to actually invalidate the teachers' union measure that would substantially regulate the voucher program. But there's a lot of obstacles and things that need to happen before then. First of all, you know, they collected, I think, 420,000.
Something like that.
Well, remember that in paid signature collection, you look at a validity rate of about 65%. So that automatically knocks hundreds of thousands signatures out. Then you start to look at things like, you know, what was said in order to get people to sign. And so I bring all of those up because those are the legal challenges that the pro-voucher groups have already said they will be waging in the courts. And so first we have to watch whether all those signatures make it. Then we'll look at the language itself and whether there are any legal challenges to the way the language is written. And that's for any of these measures.
Yeah.
Then we'll know what we actually do and don't get to vote on. And
right.
When there's both a pro-reform and an anti-reform measures on the same ballot, normally whichever one gets the highest number of votes will win if they're in conflict with one another. But there's a legal question this time of whether that still pertains if one is constitutional.
Right. The one the legislature referred with the poison pill
is it constitutional? The poison pill is constitutional.
Yeah.
The public school advocate one is statutory. So is that apples and oranges? So a lot of legal questions alone until we get to November.
Yeah. Regina, do you agree with Dawn that if assuming the teachers union measure makes the ballot, do you think it passes?
It could pass, but the other one could pass also. I think what happens when you have competing initiatives, the public's confused. Mm-hmm. They don't know what they're voting on. And so you could end up with both of them. If you end up with both of them, then the legal challenge is whether the teachers union one gets thrown out or not.
Right.
I think a better way – I'm not a big fan of initiatives. I think it's hard. It's just like the one we were talking about earlier where you have three parts to it.
Mm-hmm.
The public doesn't always see the little intricacies that you have in those initiatives. So I would have loved to have seen a compromise happen with the legislature rather than it going to the ballot.
What do you make of the fact that former Governor Ducey is stepping forward and saying he's going to be helping to lead the campaign in support of the ESA for military families that contains the provision that Dawn mentioned that basically invalidates anything else dealing with ESAs?
No surprise. No surprise. Governor Ducey's always been a big advocate of the ESA program, of the voucher program, however you want to call it. He's been huge on this. He's school choice all the way down the line. So I would definitely expect him to engage in this.
What do you see as his role or what does he bring to that campaign?
Well, 8 years of experience with it, for one thing. I think he's been a proven leader. So I could see him leading this and getting it done. He did Prop 123.
Yeah.
I mean, when we had issues with getting funding for schools, he pushed Prop 123. And honestly, he did a fantastic job.
And of course, signed the universal vouchers, right?
Yep.
This is kind of his
thing.
This
is his baby.
Yeah. So, Dawn, how do you, if you are, let's say, the teachers union and supporting that ballot measure, how do you run a campaign to basically say, vote for this one, don't vote for these other ones? Like, how do you go about doing that?
Well, on the progressive side of the House, we've had lots of experience kind of saying like, okay, we got one or two through to the ballot. The legislature put 7, 8, 11. So we have some experience saying yes on this one, no on everything else.
Okay.
You know, and that's kind of what the messaging will have to be to boil it down to the most simple version for the average voter. So it'll be yes on prop whatever, no on everything else is the messaging that'll come out of.
So you kind of do you kind of like leave the contents of the
yep.
of the measures out and just say yes on this number, no on this number?
Yes. You go back to just relying on kind of your reputation, the values that people associate with your group. You know, if you see the teachers union saying no on everything else and you're a pro schools, a pro teacher person, then rather than read the details of every single one of those measures, you're just going to say, you know, I trust the local teachers group.
Okay. Interesting. All right, guys, we have about a minute left. I want to ask you about a new poll that came out about the governor's race, the GOP primary. It showed Andy Biggs is running away with it, 60%, about 10% for David Schweikert. Is this what you believe is going to be happening?
Absolutely. I thought this was going to happen a long time ago. I was wondering why Schweikert wanted to get into the race. When Karen Taylor Robeson was in there, I thought it was a more competitive race going on. But when Schweikert jumped in and Karen came out, I knew Andy was going to run with it.
Dawn, is this what you kind of expected as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
Assuming that this is what happens.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Dawn Penich, Regina Cobb, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation.
Thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up in the next installment of our summer soapbox series, an outlandish rescue mission leads to an impromptu road trip. But first, if you've never heard of the sport of mounted shooting, take a listen to this.
Yeah! Nice.
That was the about 10 seconds it took world champion mounted shooter Kenda Lonsane to shoot 5 rounds of blanks from 2 different pistols while riding at breakneck speed on a horse around a course, and she did hit all 10 targets. Lonsane is the 6-time world champion in her sport, and she lives and works here in Arizona. And now she's being inducted into the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame. She came into our studios earlier this week to tell my co-host Lauren Gilger more about it.
I have been a cowgirl since I was born. Basically, once I was old enough to hold my own head up, I was on my own pony at age 2. And my sisters and I, we were just little cowgirls growing up. And here I am still after all this time.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about mounted shooting, because I don't think people necessarily know that this is a competitive sport or how it works. And it's quite a sport. It's timed. It is fast. It is loud.
It's basically the most fun you can have on horseback, in my opinion. It's, you know, there's a element of challenge to it because we're riding a horse at 35 miles an hour and also trying to hit targets at the same time.
Yeah.
So the timed aspect of it is really exciting because it's not a judged event. It's just me, my horse, and how I perform in the arena.
Mm-hmm.
And the fastest time wins.
The fastest time wins. How fast do you go?
Well, I guess the fastest time I've ever clocked on a course is 8.6 seconds. I know. I can't even – when I say that
I thought
out loud,
you would say minutes.
It doesn't make sense.
What happens in that 8.6 seconds?
So it's a full-sized rodeo arena and across the timing beam, which is an electronic eye, to start the clock and shoot 5 targets, holster the first gun, pull the second gun, and shoot 5 more targets. So
wow.
It's a total of 10. We have 10 rounds of blank ammunition. There's no projectile to the ammunition, so it's safe to use in a spectator environment.
Right, worth noting.
Yes. But there's a lot that goes on in those 8 seconds. And yeah. That's not typical for a nationwide course, but that was the fastest time I've logged on course before. And I mean, I have an amazing horse and I can't do it without him. He's such a great partner and we just know each other so well. So that helps too.
Yeah. And we should say the horses wear earplugs. Do you wear earplugs even though you're shooting blanks?
I do. They are, it's a 45 caliber load full of black powder and then crimped at the end, meaning there's no projectile.
Right.
However, it is loud. So yes, I do wear hearing protection and my horse does as well.
Yeah. Okay. So this must take incredible skill. How did you get into this?
The sport was headquartered in Scottsdale. Huh. And it started in 95. I joined the sport in 98. So I've been doing it for quite some time.
And almost from the beginning of it existing. Okay.
Exactly. And it started out with the cowboy shooters who shoot from the ground, and, you know, they kind of dress up in the old timey clothes. Mm-hmm. And one of them, he thought, this looks like so much fun. We should, and he was a horseman. So he said, let's try shooting targets off horseback.
Okay.
And that's literally how it was started and born all those years ago. And now it's a national and worldwide event that on any given weekend, you can go to a competition around the country.
Right. And this is what you do, right? You go around the country, around the world competing in this?
I do. I travel mostly domestically around the country, but I teach classes, I train horses for the sport, and I compete on a professional level. So it's a full-time job.
Wow. Okay. Talk about your partner, as you described your horse, right? This is an important part of this. Like you said you couldn't do this without your horse and the skill that the horse actually has, right?
Absolutely. My horse is, he's incredible. He's such an athlete. And, you know, I always relate it to this. Like, I can only be as good as I am. But if I'm riding a three-legged donkey, I'm definitely not going to turn in those top times. So it's such a partnership that I have with him. And I think any equestrian rider will vouch for that as well. Like you are literally only as good as the horse you're riding. And, you know, it's hours and hours and hours of cultivating that relationship and respect for him as a partner, as a teammate. Because, you know, when I'm out there trying to focus on my targets, I need him to go where I point him.
What's your horse's name?
His name's Charles.
Charles.
I know.
Do you remember the first time you rode with Charles?
I do. He came into my life in 2021. I had broken my leg in a freak accident, and I met his owner who put me up in his guest house because this was in Georgia.
Wow.
And he's also a shooter. So, you know, it's a kind of a family across the country.
Wow.
And turns out that he was looking for a rider to take Charles on because he said, you know, I'm 72 years old. I can't ride this horse, but I don't want him to go to waste. And you're the only person in this whole sport that I could see gelling with him.
Mm.
So would you ride him? Would you take him and make him a star? And so I did. And it was like, it was such a love connection from the minute I got in the saddle. We just, you know, peas and carrots. We're just a great team together.
How does that work? Like, I've heard people talk about the relationship with their horses, right? Like, and it sounds like this very deep connection.
No, you're right. It's, you know, it's not like a car where you just get in and you read the manual and you buy the car because you know it has all the things that you want.
Right.
I mean, they have a brain, they have a personality, and there's a level of respect, I think, for that partnership. And I mean, I don't know. I think you either get along or you don't.
Hmm.
And some horses you just don't really get along with, and then they're perfect for somebody else. So you just kind of have to find that relationship, and you know when you know.
That's really interesting. Okay, so this is one of the few rodeo events, right, where women and men compete. And you, I understand, have come out on top, even in this mixed gender sport, a couple of times. You were, in 2009, the first woman ever to win the world championship title in this sport.
Yes, it was a really big trailblazing effort for all the young women and cowgirls all over forever. It was a really big, big deal. And it still is. I still am the only woman in my sport to be on top and to have basically outrun all the men.
Have you ever trained a young woman in this sport or coached someone and hoped that they might come up and take the mantle from you one day?
Absolutely. I do coach a lot of women and young girls, and I know that that will be my place eventually.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't be an athlete forever. So there will come a time when that happens, and I hope it's one of my girls.
Yeah. Okay, so you are being inducted into the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame. And, I mean, this is quite a roster of women who have kind of shaped the history of the American West. What's this mean to you?
It's, first of all, of course, it's a big honor because I'm just a girl who likes to ride horses and shoot targets. I mean, I never expected that this would come into my life. And I think it's really validating for the nearly three decades of hard work. It still hasn't hit home yet that I'm part of that. And it's just such an honor. And I can't, it's like I said, it's really validating.
Yeah. How long do you think you'll do this? You said 28 years doing this sport and you're still the best. How long do you want to keep going?
Well, I've told myself, I've ridden three different horses to win the world. So Charles is my third. Justin was my first. I won the world twice on him. Sparky was the second, twice on her. And now mm-hmm. Charles, twice on him. And with each one of those accomplishments, I think, okay, it's time to move on. Like, at what point am I going to move on from this? But I still love it so much. I wake up and I just can't wait to go do it again. Mm. So until I either physically cannot, which, that happens to us, all of us, we're human. I've had a lot of injuries, a lot of broken bones, and it's going to catch up with me eventually. But until that spark isn't there, I'm just going to keep going.
All right. Kenda Lonsane, six-time world champion in the sport of mounted shooting and new inductee into the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame. Kenda, thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations.
Thank you. And thanks for having me today.
The New World Screwworm feels a bit like something from a gory horror movie. A flesh-eating maggot burrows into the wounds of warm-blooded animals and lays eggs for the cycle to continue. The reality is screwworm cases have been confirmed in more than 24 cows, sheep, and goats in Texas since early June, having made its way up through parts of Mexico for more than a year and a half. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Sonora, KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky reports on the cross-border efforts to get the parasite under control.
Outside the ranching cooperative store in Hermosillo, saguaro cactuses stretch toward a bright blue sky. Inside, ranchers in white cowboy hats file in to order feed and buy supplies. The walls and shelves are lined with tools, saddles, and medicine.
Sueros, vitaminas, antibióticos.
Victor Lozama is the veterinarian who runs this depot for Sonora's Cattle Ranchers Union.
Todo lo que puede utilizar en un rancho, aquí encontrarlo.
One newer addition, a pamphlet at the checkout counter. On the front is a blown-up photo of a single New World screwworm maggot, bearing its signature mouth hooks, which look like little black fangs that it uses to bury into living animal tissue.
Sonora como estado.
This Mexican border state, Sonora, directly south of Arizona, hasn't had any cases. But as the parasite has crept up from Mexico's border with Guatemala to the U.S.-Mexico border over the past year and a half, the Mexican government has been trying to reach out to ranchers. It's provided many with kits they can use to collect samples of possible screwworm maggots and send them in for testing. And it's provided ranchers with medicine to treat open wounds.
This needs to be a joint effort between government, state governments, and the ranchers.
Julio Berdeguer is Mexico's former agriculture minister who served in that position until this spring.
If you lose the trust, the collaboration of ranchers, you're dead. That's the most precious element of this.
If left untreated, the parasite can be deadly, and it now threatens the U.S.'s already low cattle supply, as confirmed cases in Texas climb past 30. Screwworm spread could raise beef prices from already sky-high levels. Its arrival in the U.S. comes as the country's cattle herd reaches a 75-year low, even as demand for beef remains strong. The average U.S. price per pound of ground beef has risen from under $4 at the start of 2020 to nearly $7 this year. Dudley Hoskins is an undersecretary at USDA.
Mexico is a critical partner in all this with us.
He says the two countries' agriculture departments have been in close contact as they try to beat back the northward spread of the New World screwworm. The U.S. formally eradicated the parasite in the 1960s by releasing sterile male flies into the environment. Those sterile flies mate with normal screwworm flies to dwindle the population, and it remains what most experts consider the most effective tool against the parasite. But in the decades since, the sterile fly program ramped down. Until this summer, a USDA facility in Panama was the only one producing sterile flies.
But we don't want very many more of these infestation zones, or it's really going to stress the supplies that we have.
Philip Kaufman is the head of the entomology department at Texas A&M University. The U.S. and Mexico are now rushing to produce more flies. Late last month, they together inaugurated a production plant in southern Mexico. It's that kind of collaboration between the two countries that Hoskins and Mexico's former agriculture minister, Berdeguer, say prevented the screwworm from arriving in the United States sooner.
Soy el ingeniero Horacio Gámez López.
Back in Sonora, Rancher Gámez López waits at the union headquarters for a meeting with the union president. Ranchers say a nearly year-long border closure for Mexican livestock to protect the U.S. from screwworm has meant prices on cattle here have plummeted, since so many more cattle stay in Sonora rather than be exported.
Mucho, fuerte, drástico.
Gámez López says that's had a drastic impact on his business. Ranchers like him say it's not fair that the stretch of border between Sonora and Arizona has remained closed, even though there have been no screwworm cases here. The USDA says it's constantly evaluating to assess when to reopen the U.S.-Mexico border to livestock. Gámez López is hopeful that the United States and Mexico will figure out how to eradicate the parasite again together so the industry here can get back to normal soon. Nina Krivinsky, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. With the valley's triple-digit high temperatures firmly upon us, taking a swim in ice-cold water may sound appealing. If so, does Chris Ballard have something for you? Ballard has been a senior writer at Sports Illustrated for two decades. He's also an author. His new book is called The Plunge, Maverick Swimmers, An Unlikely Quest, and the Transformative Power of Cold Water. In it, he meets people who do cold plunges and those who swim distances in freezing water. And he not only reports their stories, he becomes a participant. Ballard joins me to talk more about this. And Chris, what first got you interested in looking into this world? And I wonder if it's maybe a bigger world than you thought it was.
To the latter question, yes, it was a whole alternate universe I didn't know existed. So part of my interest was professional curiosity. You know, I've spent the last, you know, few decades writing about sports, but often I'm interested in the people behind the sports, and often I'm interested in more esoteric sports where you might be asking, why is someone running an ultra marathon, right? Like, why would someone do it with their body? Usually there's a fascinating reason behind that. So part of it was seeing this world of people who are not only going to cold water for, you know, wellness trends or for health benefits, which are there, but also swimming in it. And then personally, I was in my late 40s and I had always loved basketball. I spent 20 years covering basketball for Sports Illustrated. And personally, I'd hit a point where I couldn't really play anymore. And I'd had a hip replacement and it was sucking away my identity, my sense of self, my stress release, so many things I got from it. And so I'd heard from an NBA trainer. He's like, the thing that all these athletes are doing now is intense cold, where they alternate between like a 39 degree plunge tub and hot water or sauna. And I was like, hey, if it works for them, yeah, it was good enough for Steph Curry and LeBron. It's good enough for me to try to stay on the court in my weekend warrior aspect. So those two things were what drove me into it.
So did you find that it had that those kinds of effects for you? Like, were you able to get back on the court or at least maybe not be quite so sore as you had been feeling?
Yeah. It's, you know, you think of it almost like a vascular pump, because when you go into hot, whether it's a sauna or hot water or, you know, a hot tub, you know, essentially all the blood goes out to your skin because it's trying to shed heat. It's called vasodilation. So that happens first. But then when you go immediately into cold after that, your body's like, oh boy, we got to bring all the blood to the core. We got to protect the heart. So instead of going out to the skin, it comes all the way away from the skin to the heart. And that works, if you think of it almost like cycling through, if you're cleaning, like an oil change in some ways, like you're just cleaning out your system that way. So they've seen in studies that this is going to help with cellular repair. And you do feel it. I was able to get back on the court. And I've got to be honest, you know, that sort of thudding, it's called delayed onset muscle soreness, that goes away as well. So you sleep better, you rest better.
Huh. So you found all sorts of different reasons for the people who do this, not because they're trying to recover from injuries or, you know, trying to get back on the court or on the field more mm-hmm. quickly. There are all sorts of reasons, it seems like, why people choose to do this.
Yeah, I think the one that was most compelling to me was a mental health aspect. And so if you think about it from a physiological standpoint, it does make sense. When you get into cold water, your body goes into fight or flight. It sees this as a threat. And so it tries to prepare you for this threat by boosting your levels of dopamine and adrenaline. And so the side benefit to that is that you feel amazing. It's the same receptors in your head as an opioid. And so you're ready. And you're also, you really can't think about whatever was swirling around your head, the intrusive thoughts, you know, you're worried about this, you're worried about that. When you're in that cold water, you're really only present in that moment. So there's that aspect. And then if you do it with other people, that's where I found a lot of swimmers and plungers around the world. They were finding these communities. And often, you know, if people are lonely, they're scrolling social media. Here is something where really the barrier entry is just like show up on Saturday at, you know, 8 a.m.
Well, so those kinds of things, sort of the calm, the mental health aspect, the doing hard things together, it strikes me that that's not necessarily that dissimilar from, you know, you mentioned why people might run an ultra marathon or do other extreme sports. It seems like those are some of the answers you hear for those kinds of events also.
For sure. There's an element of this, you know, that I got into the extreme element of ice swimming, which is 41 degrees or lower water, and you're only wearing a silicone cap, goggles, and a Speedo. And so there's people who come to this partly to test themselves, to find that line. And that's, I think, what appeals to people who might do an ultra marathon as well. Like, you know, what are my limits? What do I find when I push my limits? So there's that aspect. But I think the difference here that you find is you rely on other people. If you go out for a run and let's say you conk out 14 miles into your run, you know, you just walk. But if you're out in very cold water and swimming with a group of other people, you need each other, because if you start to get very cold or, you know, you get disoriented, whatever it is, there's that communal element to this that is really powerful. And it's one of those things that's hard to explain. And so myself, in reporting the book, of course, I had to start doing this.
Yeah.
Otherwise, a reader isn't going to be able to really understand it. And so in doing it, I did start to feel this like amazing, wow, I met these people, you know, 2 hours ago, and suddenly I have this bond with them.
What was it like for you to start and to sort of know that you have to kind of trust these people that you met, you know, maybe less than a few minutes ago? You know, if something goes sideways, these are the people who are going to help you and possibly save your life.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I heard from the people who do the really intense ice swimming, where they swim something called an ice mile. And that's when it's just what it sounds like. You're trying to swim a mile in water that is near freezing, in this case, 41 degrees Fahrenheit or lower, is they said a lot of them are caretakers in their day-to-day life, whether it's a family member or an elderly parent, or maybe it's their job. And one of the things they appreciate about this is you put yourself in a position where you need others to take care of you. You know, there's some people who are like, I can do this on my own. I'm self-reliant. I'm independent. And this forces you outside of that in a way that, if done safely, is healthy as well. And so that is very appealing. And I think especially in our day-to-day life, we don't have many opportunities where we have to rely on each other because everything is so easy.
Well, and to your point from earlier, this is also like, yes, I'm sure that there are things you can do to prepare and precautions you can take and things like that. But at the end of the day, like, you have to actually get into the water and do it.
For sure. And to me, this was really profound with the Paralympians. So there's an actual sport called ice swimming, and they've got a shot at making the Winter Olympics. It's a great visual sport, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And there are current Olympians who are now competing in it. And in talking to these Paralympians, one of the things they said, you know, the water is 38 degrees or whatever it is they're like, part of why we do this is because 99% of the population won't. It's not that they can't, it's that they won't, and we can. So it gave them this thing that they could do, because really, Like your body will adapt to this kind of cold water within a week.
Okay, so take me through your mindset when you are standing on the edge of the water the first time you're going to do one of these things. Like, what are you thinking? What are you feeling?
Why did I decide to do this? It's usually the first
thing.
About
right.
I could have been courtside at the Lakers game writing about, you know, so there's an element of that. And then secondarily, though, by the time you're there, by the time you've, you know, in this case, when I, my first real time swimming was at the U.S. Nationals, and I'm standing on the edge of a pool and the pool is 38 degrees, but there's hundreds of people around me. There's a live stream. Mm. You really can't back out. So at that point, you got to go in, and you are up until the moment that you actually get it and do it, you're like, I'm not going to be able to do this. And then when you get out, you know, 2 minutes later or whatever your swim was, you are so proud. And it's remarkable how much we underestimate ourselves. I was so not only proud, but just surprised that I was able to do it. And that was also gratifying.
All right. That is Chris Ballard, a journalist and author. His new book is called The Plunge, Maverick Swimmers, An Unlikely Quest, and the Transformative Power of Cold Water. Chris, really good to talk to you. Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much.
And now we bring you another tale from the road in our summer soapbox essay series. Today, Phoenix musician and writer Jason Woodbury's got one for the dogs.
It had already been a long day by the time the call came. My buddy Tim on the line with an odd request. Earlier that day, he'd been on a surveying trip for work in the remote desert town of Page, located near the Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell, way up in the stark northern recess of the Grand Canyon State. While stopping for gas and road sodas en route back to the valley, he and his co-workers had noticed a strangely affectionate dog lingering by the pump. The dog made a connection. She seemed to telepathically speak to Tim. Though he was already back at his apartment in Tempe, he couldn't stop thinking about that dog. It was late in the afternoon, but he had a wild proposition. He wanted to drive the 4+ hours back to Page to get that dog. And he needed road trip partners, as that meant a 4+ hour drive home as well. Until only recently, Tim and I had been neighbors on Forest Ave in Tempe. Though I'd departed my one bedroom next to Tim's to move in with my then girlfriend, I was still only a few blocks away. I was working my first real adult job, editing the music section and online blog of the local Alt Weekly, and I was feeling worn out by the constant grind of my deadlines. Coupled with frequent late-night work as the paper's resident concert critic, with word counts to pad out looming each following morning. But I'm a sucker for magical thinking, and the idea of not spending the evening hunched over my laptop catching up on work was striking. On the surface, Tim's request sounded a little delusional. After all, there seemed little chance that the dog would still be there by the time we got there, and absolutely no chance that we'd be able to find her in the darkness if she was lingering nearby. But then again, what if it really was meant to be? I was used to late nights and early mornings anyhow, so I agreed to join him. Like they say on The X-Files, I wanted to believe. Our friend Aaron was game too. As per usual, he had details of a torrid small-town romance to get off his chest. We stopped by our buddy Zane's on our way out of town to borrow his SUV. Though he couldn't join us, he wanted to support the cause. It was probably 7 or 8 before we got properly going on the road, which felt entirely too late. We heard Gordon Lightfoot on the radio as we rolled past the turnoff to Carefree Highway, and we chatted all the way up, noting with wonder how the time on the dash clock rolled an hour backward and then forward again as we entered and exited the Navajo Nation, the only part of Arizona that observes daylight savings time. We tuned the radio to Coast AM, the crackle of George Norrie's voice droning on about Coral Castle, Florida's own Stonehenge, accompanying us as we drove. About 20 minutes away from our destination, Tim called the gas station on his cell. No one answered. Not promising. As we pulled into Page, black sky overhead, populated by stars you can't see in the city due to the light pollution, I tried not to get my hopes up. But I felt something grab me internally, and I decided, no, I would hope that the dog would be there. That by making this journey, we weren't so much willing the dog into existence, but riding her into the story's conclusion. As Tim pulled into the gas station, I couldn't see much beyond the dim light glowing from the closed convenience store windows. We stepped out, each taken aback by how cold it was. We peered into the darkness, and then, emerging from the shadows, the sigh of a golden brown dog emerging from behind the gas station, trotting up to us as if she'd been waiting. Tim glowed and popped the back of the SUV. Without hesitation, she hopped in. The drive home would bring its own delusions, along with a terrible mess for Tim to clean up before returning the car. But the whole way back, things glowed with a strange tinge of fate. An unexpected call answered, exactly as planned.
That was Jason Woodbury. To hear his essay again and check out the rest of our Soapbox collection, go to kjzz.org. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.